I think Noga knows the title already.
And orientations on graphs.
Right. So this is the title. Thanks very much for the invitation here. This is the title. When Noga saw it, he wondered what this would be about, because this is exactly the title of his paper with Tarsi. So I should say that, I'll change the title. So now the title is different, but the content will be the same. And I can put the title back again and change it so that there's no pinching of titles. So what I want to talk about is the relationship between colorings and orientations of graphs, but not just the work of Alon and Tarsi, because there are many results which relate the two concepts, but which somehow don't have a central unified structure. So one doesn't know why they all work, but there are some lovely results. Firstly, it's quite clear that if we have a coloring, then we can get an orientation for two vertices. If we color with the integers, for example, then color U is bigger than color V, we can direct the edge from U to V, and that will give us an orientation like that. And we could call that a canonical orientation, and it's acyclic, clearly. So the arrows go from larger numbers to smaller numbers. But on the other hand, we can relate colorings and orientations in various ways. And here is one of the earliest ones. If we take a directed path, a directed path is a path in which all the edges are directed the same way. And I'll denote by lambda of d the length of the longest directed path, the number of edges in the longest directed path. So as a result of Hua and Galai, independently, who proved that the chromatic number is bounded by 1 plus the length of the longest directed path, for any directed graph, where if we talk about the chromatic number of a directed graph, that'll be just the chromatic number of the underlying undirected graph. Now, if you look at the canonical orientation, let me put that up. If you look at this canonical orientation, you see that the length of a longest directed path is going to be at most 3 to 2 to 1. So, in fact, it's going to be equal by this theorem. And if we put these two observations together, we in fact get an expression for the chromatic number of a graph in terms of the lengths of longest paths in its orientations. So an exact expression for the chromatic number. So there's a very strong link. Now I'd like to show you the proof of this, because it uses an idea which I will come back to. Don't drop any pieces. So let's we want to prove this. The result of Roy and Galai. Well, let's take an ordering of the vertices in which as many edges go from left to right. So we'll call this a median ordering. This is what it's called in the literature, a median ordering. minimum feedback ordering, if you like. So we order the vertices, and the red edges go from left to right, and the blue edges go from right to left, and we want as many red edges as possible. So we want to maximize the number of red edges. Now, let me say something about this ordering, first of all, because it's very useful in proving various results. Firstly, we can't have a blue edge between two consecutive vertices, because we could just switch these two vertices and do better. We'd have more red edges. So there are no blue edges joining consecutive vertices. And more generally, if we look at, what should we do here? If we take any interval here, this first vertex in the interval must be joined to at least half the vertices, or at least half its neighbors must be, at least half its neighbors must be going in the right direction, because otherwise we would put this vertex down here and we would gain. So at least half its neighbors in the interval must be in the red graph. Now, just looking at this median order, we can see very quickly that there must be, in a tournament, if we take a tournament, there must be a directed Hamilton path, because in a tournament any two vertices are joined, and we saw before that we don't have any blue edges going this way between consecutive vertices, so they must be red edges. They must all be going in the same direction. And so in a tournament, we have a directed Hamilton path. Now, how do we use this for proof of Galois? Well, this is the proof that they used. Let's assign a coloring to the vertices. So we have this median order. Let's assign a coloring in which the color of a vertex is the length of a longest directed path in the red subgraph, going from left to right. The length of a longest directed path. Now, suppose we have a red edge joining two vertices U and V. Then the color of U will be larger than the color of V, because starting here we have a longer directed path than from here. We can tag this edge on to a directed path starting here, and so we get a longer directed path. So, in other words, this coloring is good in the red subgraph. So it's a proper coloring of the red subgraph. And we can do the same. We can look at the blue subgraph as well. Now, in the blue subgraph, suppose we have an edge joining two vertices U and V. Well, if we have an edge joining two vertices U and V, then that must make a directed cycle with this. Otherwise, we would have put the... now, why is that? Because if it did... Right, it's still in the acyclic graph. So, I don't see that. Yes, okay. So, we must have a directed cycle with this using red edges. And if we have a red cycle using red edges, that means that we have a path from U to V in the red graph, and that means that the color of U is bigger than the color of V. So, in any case, the color of U and the color of V are different. Because this is a maximal, in fact, this is a maximal acyclic subgraph. It has to be a maximal acyclic subgraph. That's another way, a largest acyclic subgraph. So we can't add another edge. If we add any other edge, we must make a cycle, a directed cycle. So that's a proper coloring in the red subgraph, a proper coloring in the blue subgraph, so it's a proper coloring in the whole graph. That's the proof of the Galois theorem. Now let's look at circuits. Well, here's a very simple observation to start with. Let's look at circuits in a directed graph, not directed circuits necessarily. And let's pick an orientation for a circuit and call C plus the set of edges going in the positive direction and C minus the set of edges going in the negative direction. Then and let's call a digraph circuit balanced if we have the same number of edges for every circuit, the same number of edges going in the positive direction and negative direction. Then it's very easy to see that G is too colorable if and only if it has a circuit balanced orientation. You see, if it's too colorable, we can just direct all the edges downwards, the canonical coloring, in fact. And if it has a circuit balanced orientation, of course, each circuit has an even number of edges, so the graph is bipartite. Okay? Well, this is a special case of something more interesting. We can look at the ratio of C plus and C minus. So let's do that, and let's define the imbalance. Let's define the imbalance of a circuit to be, in a directed graph, to be the ratio, well, we'll make it at least one, but the ratio of positive edges to negative edges on that circuit. So we look at the edges going clockwise and counterclockwise, take the ratio, but make sure that's at least one. Minty proved that for any orientation of a directed graph, of an undirected graph, in other words, the chromatic number is at most 1 plus the largest imbalance, where we take the ceiling there. And in fact, if one considers the canonical orientation, we easily see that we have the reverse inequality. So, in fact, we have another expression for the chromatic number in terms of balance of circuits. So if we take the chromatic number, it turns out to be 1 plus the minimum over all orientations of the maximum imbalance of a circuit. So we choose an orientation in which the circuits are as balanced as possible, and that will give us the chromatic number exactly. Maybe acyclic. Yes, you're right. For acyclic orientations, this one is acyclic. You're right. I think that's because if there's if there are cycles, I suppose we could say that's infinite or something like that. Yeah. Now this was extended not long ago by Tuza. Or Minty's theorem was extended by Tuza, where he proved that we in fact only have to, well, we can state it this way: the chromatic number is at most k if and only if the imbalance is at most k minus 1 for every circuit just of length congruent to 1 modulo k. In other words, we don't have to look at all circuits, but just the circuits of length 1 modulo k. And if it's true that the imbalance for each of those circuits is at most k minus 1, then the chromatic number is at most k. And this turns out to generalize, to extend Minty's theorem and also the Galois theorem. It also says that if there are no circuits in the graph of length congruent to 1 mod k, then the chromatic number is at most k. So here's another expression for the chromatic number in terms of orientations of graphs. Okay, well, we come to circular colorings. I'm going to talk about some things which are well known to some of you, but perhaps not to everybody. So circular colorings, a KD coloring of a graph. This is a generalization of a coloring, a proper coloring. K is at least D, or greater than D. And we have a coloring where we require that the difference in colors lies between D and K minus D. So essentially, a large difference between colors. If D is 1, we just have a regular coloring, a normal coloring, proper coloring. For example, the 5 circuit here has a 5-2 coloring because here is a coloring in 5 colors where the difference is at least 2, in fact, is equal to 2 in ZK for every edge. So we have this property holding. So that's a 5-2 coloring. And Vince defined the circular chromatic number to be the smallest or the infimum. It turns out to be a minimum, but to be the infimum of K over D for which G has a KD coloring. So, for example, the circular chromatic number of the 5 circuit is at most 5 halves. The chromatic number is 3, but the circular chromatic number is at most 5 halves. Well, it turns out, and this is by considering regular matroids and considering flows in co-graphic matroids, Godin, Tarsi, and Zhang proved that we have an exact expression for this circular chromatic number in terms of orientations, again in terms of this imbalance. But
there's also a much simpler proof directly by the same method as Minton's.
Oh, yeah? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure which is simpler.
Well, it doesn't use matroids in any other structure.
But I think Guido Uri had a proof, but perhaps that was also, or had a theorem which implies it, which doesn't use matroids. So anyway, here we have the circular chromatic number expressed again in terms of orientations, and there's a very slight difference between the chromatic number in that for the chromatic number, where do we have it? For the chromatic number, we had the ceiling function by Minter's theorem, and for the circular chromatic number we don't, and that shows that the chromatic number and the circular chromatic number are very closely related in this way. So the circular chromatic number is a refinement of the chromatic number, and it has been explored in much depth in the last few years. Now, I should say a little bit about other chromatic numbers. In fact, I won't say much. But we've been talking, and what I want to focus on is the chromatic number of the underlying graph. All these results are related to the chromatic number of the underlying graph. But one can define a chromatic number for directed graphs, which is called the oriented chromatic number. And perhaps the best way to see the relationship with these other concepts is through homomorphisms. So a homomorphism is a mapping of vertices to vertices, which takes edges to edges. And a proper K-coloring is then a homomorphism to a complete graph. We just put all independent sets of one color onto a single vertex of the complete graph. A KD-coloring is a homomorphism to the complement of a power of a circuit, CKD minus 1 complement. And, the oriented chromatic number is, an oriented K coloring is a homomorphism to a tournament on K vertices. Now, the difference between a regular colouring and an oriented colouring is that if we colour two vertices, red and blue, and there's an edge from red to blue, then all edges between red and blue have to go from red to blue. They have to go in the same direction. And that gives us a homomorphism to a tournament. And this is it's a difficult concept, which, there's a problem for on the oriented chromatic number of planar graphs, where the bounds are between 16 and 80, I think. But I won't be talking about this concept, oriented K-coloring. So I'd like to mention a couple more relations between, these are now by now classical relations between colorings and orientations. One is via chromatic polynomials. So the chromatic polynomial, well, one can define it to be, this is defined to be the number of proper K colorings of a graph, where we distinguish between colorings 1, 2, and 2, 1. In other words, if the colors are different, then we say they're different colorings. It's not the partition which counts, but the actual colors. Birkhoff, around this time, I don't remember the date, but beginning of the century, investigated chromatic polynomials and proved this recurrence relation, this relation between a graph, the number of colorings of a graph, the number in the edge-deleted graph, for an edge, not a loop, and the number in the contracted graph. It's this simple relationship between these numbers. And that implies that this is, in fact, a polynomial in K of degree, the order of the graph. So that's why it's called the chromatic polynomial. Now, we could also define the number of acyclic orientations of a graph. So the number of ways in which the graph can be oriented so that there are no directed circuits at all. For example, the canonical coloring would be one. Stanley proved, again, if he is not a loop, we have this recurrence relation, which is very similar. So the number of acyclic, these are very easy to prove. And as a consequence, well, these satisfy essentially the same recurrence relation. And if one checks the initial conditions, one can prove quite easily. This is an exercise for the students who are attending this, that the number of acyclic orientations is just minus 1 to the n times the chromatic polynomial at minus 1. Now, we're talking about K colorings, and whatever a minus 1 coloring means, nobody knows, but for some reason, we have this relationship. And, this is another connection between colorings and orientations of graphs. I don't know any unified treatment of these topics. Do you know, Gar? Not just the polynomials, but the various results. No. So this is a general open area, somehow to find, I don't know if it makes sense even, but to try and find connections, natural connections between these rather diverse results. Okay, now we come to the topic of the title of the talk. This is the graph polynomial, which in fact was studied already in the last century by Sylvester and Peterson and so on, various people. So we have an ordering labeling of the vertices v1 up to vn. We take n variables x1 up to xn, and we form this product for each edge of the graph. We can assume that I is less than j. This will just change the sign. This is defined up to within the sign. product of xi minus xj. The interest from the point of view of colorings is that it's clear that if we have a proper vertex coloring, then the value of this polynomial will be non-zero, at least if the colors are integers, for example, and conversely. So this is a natural connection between this polynomial and colorings. But that's the obvious part. The less obvious part is what Noga, Alon, and Miki Tarsi proved. I won't give the full details of this, or even the full statement of the result. These polynomials, by the way, were looked at already some time ago by various people, Lee and Lee, by Lovas and Kleitman, Kleitman and Lovas, Ron Graham, in connection with independent numbers, independent sets, and colorings. But they didn't, I don't think they came up with this connection, which is really quite remarkable. Suppose we expand our polynomial. Suppose we expand our polynomial and look at all the monomials and collect them together, then there'll be some monomials with non-zero coefficients and some with zero coefficients. Some might cancel out. And what Alon and Tarsi proved, in particular, was that suppose we have a monomial, which I'll write x to the d, but it's x1 to the d1 times x2 to the d2, etc. If the coefficient is not zero, and if we take a set of di plus 1, a set of size di plus 1, for I between 1 and n, then there will be a choice of an element of Si, alpha I in Si, for each I, such that this polynomial will have a non-zero value. And if this polynomial has a non-zero value, of course that means that we have a proper coloring. So, from what we mentioned over there. So, in the language of choosability, this means that in this case, if we have these two conditions holding, then G is D plus 1, we could write D plus 1 choosable, where D plus 1 is the vector D1 plus 1, D2 plus 1, and so on. So G is D plus 1 choosable. In other words, if we pick, there is a way of picking a color from the list S1, a color from the list S2, and so on, so that we have a proper coloring. So this is the... result, and in particular, this gives an upper bound on the chromatic number, which is that the chromatic number is at most 1 plus the maximum di. So, let me now. How do we look at these monomials? How do we understand when the coefficients are zero or not? Well, this is all to do with orientations of graphs, as Alon and Tarsi pointed out. So let's take a graph. Take a graph. Now I've missed some. I'm losing something here. That's not serious. Let's take a graph and We want to see that, look at the monomials. Well, each monomial before cancellation corresponds to choosing one of these two elements, one of these two variables, and so on. So, for example, we might pick, we'll look at x1 squared, x2, x3, x4. We could get that by picking x1, x3, x1, x2, x4, and that corresponds in the natural way to an orientation. The element we pick should be the tail of the edge, of the corresponding edge. So x1 is the tail of the edge, x1, x2, and so on. And then what do we get? I should write that down, x1 squared. Yeah. X1 squared. X2, x3, x4. Then we get an orientation in which the out degree of x1 is 2. The out degree is the exponent, exactly the exponent. The out degree is exactly the exponent. Now we'll call an orientation, this orientation, we'll call an orientation even. We'll call it even if we pick, if the second element is picked an even number of times. So here we've picked x3, we've picked x4, that's twice. So we'll call this an even orientation. And here's an odd orientation with exactly those out degrees. And that corresponds to this choice, x2, x1, x1, x3, x4. And that's odd because we've picked the second element once, twice, three times. And of course, if we have an odd orientation, that will give a negative sign to this monomial. And if we have an even orientation, that will give a positive sign to the monomial. In fact, there's another one here, which is odd as well. There's another orientation. So we have this connection between the... So let's write this down. Let's put it here. Between the orientations with a particular out degree sequence, D, and... So G of D, let's call that G of D. That's the set of all orientations of our graph with a given out degree sequence D. So X1 has out degree D1 and so on. Now if we fix one element in here, then any other element will be there if and only if it can be obtained by reorienting the edges of an Eulerian, a directed Eulerian subgraph of G. And then we can define, if we assume that G is even, for example, then we can define a partition of GD into two parts, O of D, odd of D, and even of D. So H bar is in odd D if this Eulerian subgraph has an odd number of edges, and otherwise it's in E of D. It's if there's an even number of edges in this Eulerian subgraph, which we reorient. And it's quite easy to see if we use this notation that if the number of odd orientations is different from the number of even orientations, then the graph is D plus one choosable using the result of Potocki et al. So now there's a way of seeing this which I like using bipartite graphs. So we could form a bipartite graph . It's quite natural. In fact, if we take an element in O of D and an element in E of D, so an odd orientation and an even orientation, they differ by an odd number of edges, and an Eulerian subgraph which has an odd number of edges has a directed odd circuit. So let's make up, this is quite natural to do, let's make up a bipartite graph and join two orientations if they differ, in other words, if one can be reoriented to the other, well, by changing the directions of an odd directed circuit, just an odd directed circuit, not an Eulerian subgraph. So we have a bipartite graph here. Now, it's clear that if there are no directed odd circuits, then one side is going to be empty, because if there's one vertex in O of D and one vertex in E of D, then every vertex on either side will have degree at least one if there are some vertices on the other side. So if there are no directed odd circuits, then automatically we have this condition holding. One of these is empty, and the graph is D plus one choosable. Now, I'd like to just look at complete graphs. This is a rather trivial case, but is instructive, I think. So let's take a complete graph. So what are the orientations? Excuse me. The orientations are just tournaments with a given nth degree sequence. And it's quite easy to prove, this is an exercise for the students again, that there are exactly the same number of directed triangles in each of these tournaments, specified by the number of by the nth degree sequence, determined by the nth degree sequence. Now suppose that's non-zero, in other words it's positive. Then if we look at our bipartite subgraph, our bipartite graph, and if we just look at the edges which correspond to reversing on these directed triangles, each vertex will have the same degree, because each tournament has the same number of directed triangles. So it can be converted to an orientation of the opposite type in the same number of ways, which means that this bipartite graph has a regular spanning subgraph. If it has a regular spanning subgraph, it means that the number of vertices on both sides are the same, and so that means that the coefficient of x to the d is zero. On the other hand, so we can't say anything about those orientations. On the other hand, if this is zero, so there are no directed triangles, so that means this tournament is transitive, and if the tournament is transitive, then the degree sequence, the out degree sequence, will be something like 0, 1, 2, up to n minus 1 in some permutation. And then the Alon-Tarski result theorem says that G is 1, 2, 3, the complete graph is 1, 2, 3, up to n list colorable, which is pretty obvious, but that's all one can say about the complete graph. In fact, one can see these coefficients in another way. This is well known because the graph polynomial of a complete graph is just this determinant, and one sees that one just gets the terms which correspond transitive tournaments. Now, there's another well-known application. I'll just mention it briefly. Well, it's one of the successes of the method, the circuits plus triangles graph. So we have a Hamilton circuit of length 0 modulo 3, or 3 times n, and n triangles, so that every vertex has degree 4. And obviously this has chromatic number at least 3 because there are triangles. Erdős made the conjecture, rather wild conjecture, bold conjecture, I would say, and you'll see why in a second, that the chromatic number is exactly 3. And this was proved by Fleischmann and Stiebitz by counting Eulerian orientations. So we were concerned with the vector, the out degree vector 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. So every vertex has in degree 2 and out degree 2. And what they proved was that this is congruent to 2 modulo 4. Well, that doesn't immediately, obviously, imply that the number of even orientations differs from the number of odd orientations, but it's true because with every orientation, one can associate its dual orientation, reversing each edge. And so the number of odd orientations and the number of even orientations are both even, and so this does imply that the number of odd orientations is different from the number of even orientations. That implies that so the graph is 3 colorable, even 3 list colorable. And that was Erdős's conjecture. Well, since then, an alternative proof was found of the 3 colorability, was found by Horst Sachs, by showing that the number of 3 colorings is odd. Now, these proofs are not easy, I think. Neither of these are inductions, but they're not obvious inductions. It would be nice to have a slightly simpler proof of that and to really understand why this works. Now, let me propose a similar question. So here's a circuit plus quadrangles graph. No triangles at all. Graph of girth 4. So we have a Hamilton circuit of length 12 and 4 circuits. Is this 3 colorable? Is it true that the number of even Eulerian orientations is different from the number of odd orientations? Forbidden to no. Oh, in here, this is just this particular graph. But in general, no.
Right,
no. No, no. But it's not true. So this is a well-known graph, which is the smallest graph, smallest 4 regular, 4 chromatic graph of girth 4. So it's not 3 colorable. So this makes one wonder exactly why things work so well for the cycles plus triangles graph. Incidentally, it's perhaps interesting to look at the coefficients more closely because it seems as though one can say even more about the coefficients than the fact that they're non-zero. So in other words, if we look at the circuit plus triangles case, if we're looking at the graph polynomial, so we're looking at the term x1 squared, x2 squared, and so on in the graph polynomial, and it's non-zero by this result, but in fact, even but non-zero, but in fact, it seems to have even more structure, so have even more properties. So the coefficients, perhaps one can say even more about the coefficients, not that they're non-zero, but something even stronger in general. Well, there are other applications. Perhaps I won't go into this, but there are certainly other applications. Noga will be able to tell you everything about it. It has an article on applications of the method. So I don't want to go into that at all. And Doug West has talked last week about extending this to hypergraphs. What I would like to spend the rest of the time, how much time is there? Not much. So another few minutes, on unavoidable subgraphs, just to mention a few questions and point out a few results. So let's call a directed graph. Now we have a directed graph. Let's call it K unavoidable if it must appear in every K-chromatic graph, digraph. So if you take any I graph whose underlying chromatic number is K, you must find a copy of this graph. Now, the Galois theorem says that the directed K plus 1 path, K minus 1 path, is K unavoidable. In other words, we must have a K minus 1 path in every K chromatic graph. What else can we say? What does the chromatic number force in terms of directed graphs? Now, I'll say most about tournaments because most is known about tournaments, and then I'll mention a few questions for graphs in general. So a tournament is an n-chromatic graph where n is the number of vertices. Redé proved that there's a directed Hamilton path. That's a special case. Well, proved it earlier. A special case of the Galois theorem. There's always a directed Hamilton path. Now, we could look at anti-directed paths, for example. We can look at all sorts of things. And in fact, one doesn't want to look at circuits because, in general, for a K-chromatic graph, because the circuits can be arbitrarily large, so one can't specify things as precisely. Now, for anti-directed paths, well, there are some exceptions. There are tournaments which don't have anti-directed paths. It's easy to see in these two cases, and a little bit more difficult in terms of the Paley tournament, where one takes these three arcs and rotates. That's a well-known tournament. It doesn't have an anti-directed Hamilton path. So none of these have anti-directed Hamilton paths. Well, Grunbaum and Rosenfeld proved...
No KD or just the case of...
That particular one. That particular one, yeah. 3, 5, and 7. I'll come to that. So it turns out that you can always find an anti-directed Hamilton path in every other tournament. Well, we could ask about other sorts of paths, because there are many types of paths. So let's define the type of a path to be, well, let's just define it by forward edges being plus and backward edges minus, and so we're looking at all strings of pluses and minuses of length n minus 1 if we have n vertices. We might as well assume that we start off with a plus, otherwise we can take the converse tournament, the dual tournament. Now, there was a conjecture by Moshe Rosenfeld in the 70s that every tournament on at least 8 vertices has a Hamilton path of every possible type. There was a result of Fourcade, who proved it in the case of tournaments whose orders are a power of 2. And he did this by, in fact, this is a special case, he proved, in fact, that the number of Hamilton paths of each type is odd. And in fact, he proved that for any tournament, I mean, on n vertices, the parity of the number of Hamilton paths of any given type depends only on n, doesn't depend on the tournament. It was an even stronger result. But in particular, this is a very pretty result. Andrew Thomason proved Rosenfeld's conjecture for a very, I think it's 2 to the 1111, but it's a large number anyway. But if n is large enough, then it's true. And more recently, my student Frédéric Ave and colleague Stefan Thomasé proved that it's always true, and there are only these three exceptions, and for these three exceptions, it's just the anti-directed path which is missing. So a complete result there. I think that's just appeared. Now let's look at trees in tournaments, just briefly. I don't know how much... I should stop in a minute, shouldn't I? So. Let's look at trees in tournaments. Well, here's a natural conjecture that, in a regular, I should put regular, sorry. No, this is okay. This is the conjecture, this was a conjecture of Saxon Schoch, that in any tournament of odd order, well, in any tournament we have a vertex of our degree at least n over 2, so one could hope that one could find a suitable vertex so that one would have n over 2, or n minus 1 over 2 neighbors, and n minus 1 over 2 second neighbors, which form a tree in this fashion. This seems to be very reasonable. But it turns out not to be true. There's a rather complicated counterexample due to Liu. And Liu proved various results, including the following, which is rather pretty. Let's define a Liu arborescence. So it's not going to be exactly like this. It's going to have branches of length of most 2, either of length 1, or of length 2 like that, or of length 2 with just 2, just one bifurcation like that. So a rather special arborescence. And he proved that every tournament has a spanning arborescence of that type. And I'd like to just indicate that very, very briefly. So let's put that over there. It's not so difficult if one sees it properly. Take a vertex. In fact, it works if the root is a vertex of maximum out degree. One looks at the neighbors, all the neighbors, and then they're the non-neighbors, the ones not in the out neighborhood of V. So let's call these X and these Y. Now, what one wants is... What one wants is something like this to add on. In other words, one really has a bipartite subgraph here, and one wants a subgraph here in which each of these vertices has degree 1, and these vertices have degree 0, 1, or 2 at all. And it's a consequence of Hall's theorem. One can use Hall's theorem to guarantee such a subgraph. Things work out so that one can show that in a tournament this always exists where V is a vertex of maximum out degree. Okay. Almost to the end, I just want to show you one other nice proof.
The application of this is that if you have degree of those 3/8,
then right. Then if you have degree at most 3/8...
the root of your spanning.
Right. Then you can get... yes, exactly. Let's look at non-spanning trees. So we take a tournament. This isn't really about chromatic number now. It's more about tournaments, but I'll just mention a few questions afterwards about chromatic number. Sumner made this conjecture, which is a very nice one. Take any tournament on 2n vertices, then this should contain every oriented tree, every orientation of every tree on n plus 1 vertices, on roughly half the vertices. And so there was work done by Hagfist and Thomason on this. This result, so they proved an asymptotic result. Havet and Thomasay proved this for arborescences. In other words, they proved that every tournament on 2n vertices contains each arborescence, each oriented tree where everything goes out from the root on n plus 1 vertices. And they proved the general conjecture, but replacing 2n by 4n, or 4n minus 2. Our argument is very simple. They improved this afterwards as well, but I won't go into that, but not up to 2n. What's the argument? Well, so this is the theorem. Well, you take a median order, So you take your tournament, take a median order, in other words, maximize the number of edges from left to right, and just consider those edges. Forget about the other edges. So just consider those edges. Take your tree and do it by, we do this, this goes by induction. You take your tree, delete a leaf, and knock off two vertices at the end of your median order. And that will be a median order of the subgraph of the tournament which remains. That will be median order of the tournament which remains. Now put back your tree minus this leaf. So forget about this. Put this back. Look at where this vertex is, and it turns out there's always enough room. By induction, one can show that there's always enough room. To, in other words, to the right, there will be a vertex which is not yet in the tree, which is adjacent to this vertex. So one can extend the embedding. And this goes very, very simply and very smoothly. And in fact, for the other result, all one has to do is chop off two vertices at the front and two vertices at the back, at both ends. And one can show that then there is a spanning tree of every type of order n plus one. Not a spanning tree, a tree, an oriented tree. Okay, so I'm going too long now. I should stop. I won't go into general digraphs. Sorry, there are some problems. Here's just general problems. Perhaps I'll just leave these up and stop. I didn't mention the Burr conjecture. I think I'll quit here. There are some general questions and one or two specific questions, but I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you.